Well, Saturday marks the third anniversary of that terrible earthquake in Haiti. Thousands killed. Our next guest, one of the survivors.
The world turned gray and everything blurred, things falling long after there should have been nothing left to fall. The horizontal slats of the crank-out windows shot from their frames and burst across the floor. I watched the front wall crack in two, daylight pushing through the throbbing dust. With every heartbeat, the floor disappeared from under me and reappeared and was gone. It was going to fall. I was going to fall. I heard a sound like trees being mowed down in a forest. It was the house next door collapsing. Seconds to go. I thought about running through the shattered glass and tumbling down the stairs, but there was no time. When the second floor went, I could either be under it or ride down on top of it. I went with on top and braced for the pain.
Jonathan Katz reading from his new book, The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. He was the only full-time American reporter in Haiti at the time. He worked for the AP. He says the enormous talent, money, and goodwill of the response left this legacy. Having sought to prevent riots, responders helped spark them. Looking to ensure stability, they undermined it. Hoping to prevent disease, they, by all evidence, caused it. And Jonathan Katz joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
Wow, quite a powerful read. Just the title, The Big Truck That Went By?
Basically, it was actually a name for the earthquake a number of Haitians gave. In Creole, it's Gwo Machine Ki Passe, The Big Truck That Went By. But it also hearkened to the fact that on a normal day in Port-au-Prince, you've got these huge trucks rumbling through the streets, shaking the houses, delivering basic services that like water or power for a generator than other countries would be delivered by the state or by a wire or by a pipe. And so it was hearkening to both the dissolution of the state and the sound that the earthquake made, and then finally, of course, the imagery of the big truck of aid that came in response.
Well, and we're going to talk about that in a second, but first these moments, you know, after this thing happens, it's just a horror. You describe, you know, as you move away from the house that collapsed, hands and feet sticking out of rubble. You shortly go over pictures that you'd snapped, you know, right in the aftermath, and you realize that, you know, there were heads in the rubble of people who were alive, faces looking right at you. You didn't know it at the time, and it's not likely you could have done anything. I mean, it's just, is there a way you have in the writing gotten this across? But when people ask you, what was it like, can you really say?
We can talk about the smell and the sound and the sensation and the fear. But even for me now, trying to recall, I don't even know if my own memories do justice to the totality of the experience while we were in it. I don't think the human mind, fortunately, is programmed to be able to really relive a moment like that or the moments after in full, because otherwise it would be impossible to do anything else with your life.
Well, I have to say, I was in a much smaller earthquake once in Los Angeles, but still, you know, thrown on the floor. And I called 911, and I'm thinking, I'm a reporter. I can relay what's happened. And she said, what happened? And I said, a big monkey just hit my house with a telephone pole.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I can relate. Yeah, exactly.
Well, you mentioned the smell. Eventually, people putting, you know, toothpaste on their upper lip to try to block it. Mm-hmm. A keening sound that you've only heard in Haiti. What was that?
There is a sound that people make, and especially women in Haiti, in the face of a tragedy. I was there in the years that I was there. We covered a number of hurricanes. There was a horrible school collapse actually right behind my house in 2008, in which about 100 people, mostly students, died. And there's the sound of mourning and of fear and exasperation and a cry for help that I would hear in those circumstances. But you would often hear it from one parent immediately after the earthquake. The next sound, basically, after the sound of the earth rumbling was this cry. It came from everywhere. It seemed really like everyone in a city that at the moment of the quake had been home to about 3 million people was crying out.
Well, then the world starts pouring in. Aid groups, CNN, Sean Penn, Bill Clinton, everyone looking for the miracles. That seemed to be the next phase, you know, the miracle of someone being discovered. And then you describe a scene in which the CNN reporter Ivan Watson is standing where a young girl has been discovered. And again, this is on, you know, being broadcast, people watching to see this 11-year-old girl freed, the miracle. But let's just listen for a second.
It is kind of heartbreaking to hear this because she's pinned there. The right leg is underneath the concrete, and her hands are free and her leg is free, and she's talking to us. They're trying to give her some drinking water.
Well, the miracle doesn't happen. You know, she's not saved. And it seems to me that this becomes a metaphor for a big, big darn turning point. Just talk about the immediate response. What went wrong?
You've got responders who are coming in to extremely confusing and chaotic and terrifying circumstance, but they're also coming in with a lot of baggage, and a lot of that has to do with a notion based in many cases on real historical events, but is mostly misbegotten, that Haiti is an extremely violent place, that people are going to react to basically anything, including a tragedy like this that hit them and themselves and their families in such a personal way by lashing out and being violent. And as such, the military really came in, especially the U.S. military, as, you know, the tip of the spear. And so they set up command and control methodologies in which they would be concentrated in small areas, usually at the airport. They would fan out briefly, kind of on, you know, very military precise sorties to go target a building, help the people in there, and then rush back before nightfall so that they wouldn't be out in the situation they were imagining was just going to be horribly dangerous. And what that did was it created a circumstance in which there were large areas that were not receiving help. And also it helped recreate this circumstance in which the same couple of sites kept getting all the attention because the media was going there and we were talking about it. And so they could rescue people from the Hotel Montana and the UN headquarters and places where essentially wealthy people and foreigners had been.
Well, the other thing that you point to is that when the military was the tip of the spear and the first to come in and centralized in these bases, the people went to those bases, and that set the stage for the encampments and for this congested kind of, instead of decentralizing people and getting them out of the cities and getting them out into other areas, it became a magnet that drew them in. But also, it feels in your description of it as a sort of a recolonization of Haiti, because it seemed as if everything was being done to them and for them, but not with their involvement.
People were just sort of doing whatever seemed right or whatever their own protocols were or whatever they had done in some very different circumstances, some very different part of the world.
Boxes of Danish hand puppets came.
You can imagine somebody in Denmark thinking, these poor children, I see the pictures, they're crying. If only there was something there that could bring them some comfort. And that's a great notion, but it doesn't really work unless you're coordinating. You know, somebody can actually sort out the hand puppets from the food, from the bandages. It's very obvious in hindsight, but some of these things were even very clear at the time. Nobody was really taking time to stop and think about it.
And one of the things you think they should have thought about is that this assumption that Haiti is corrupt, and there is corruption, but that then became an excuse for countries and aid agencies to go around the government, which further weakened it and didn't fix long-term problems. As you say, aid agencies have to take a chance on the local government. That's Jonathan Katz. His new book is The Big Truck That Went By. It's about the earthquake in Haiti 3 years ago this Saturday. When we come back, Haiti is still in crisis. More about what could have made it different with Jonathan in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Jonathan Katz, author of the new book, The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. 3 years after that earthquake that hit January 12, 2010, thousands of Haitians are still in tent cities. There's still a lack of water and food. Of course, Hurricane Sandy destroyed the country's crops. More than $16 billion was either donated or pledged. But Jonathan, you say that figure is fictive because some of it was not spent, although we read today the Boston-based group Partners in Health says it did spend the $123 million it pledged after the quake. Still, 3 years later, Haiti still in crisis. You say it would have been better if the money had gone directly to the Haitian government, people who speak the language. They would have hired Haitians to build stronger housing or plant trees, part of the reason Haiti's had such a terrible go. It's so deforested. Tell us more.
What needed to happen in Haiti, and what still needs to happen in Haiti, are the development of strong national institutions, things that can take care of these things. You can build a road, but if you don't have a transportation ministry that's capable of maintaining that road, it doesn't really matter.
And could any of the aid agencies, could the U.S. government, could Bill Clinton, could we have made this change? Is there a way that outsiders could have demanded of the Haitian government that they create these institutions?
Well, it would be a little unreasonable to demand that they create it without giving them the resources money to do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's, you know, I mean, money is hugely important, but the structure of this, the structure of this situation, of this transaction is also extremely important. I think you're asking the right question. I think you're asking the question that everybody has. It's like, well, if we had only spent it on X instead of Y, would we have had a different outcome? And it's a little hard to say in any particular instance. You know, well, if only we had given it to this guy instead of this guy, something different would have happened. But what it really is that everything has to change. The way that it's done has to change. We're seeing it right now. In Canada, there was an announcement a couple days ago. It was sort of an unintentional announcement. It came in an interview between the Minister of International Cooperation and a newspaper in Quebec, in which he sort of announced on the slide that all aid to Haiti was being frozen. And since then, they've walked it back a little bit. But in the process of walking it back, they've recreated this situation again. They say, well, you know, because there's corruption and because the Haitians haven't made the progress on their own that Canadians, and this was the phrase that was translated in this interview, that Canadians have a right to expect, it's backwards in so many ways. Because what we're looking at in that situation is a purported giver of aid who is actually spending large portions of that aid on their own agencies, on NGOs based from their own country, on their own projects that are their own priorities, that are not necessarily the priorities of the people that they're trying to help. They are characterizing that as aid to these people, and then they are blaming those people for not having done enough with it. So corruption is real, but by saying, like, oh, you people are too corrupt, so I'm just going to have to hold this money on my own. But then when I don't do what I've set out to do with it in the first place, I'm then going to blame you. It doesn't make any sense. The whole thing has to be revised. It really has to be a structural change. And then we can hopefully start seeing progress, you know, but if the progress is only done on the same scale on which the degradation, or on the same timeline on which the degradation was done over the decades before, it's going to take decades more to fix even still. So, but, you know, but it has to start. The damage has to stop at some point, and we at least have to begin working toward progress.
Well, and you say do it before the next emergency. Change the structure now and commit to, for instance, giving to NGOs and organizations within a country. Commit to it now so that it's ready to be done the next emergency. So Haiti is still in crisis. What about you? You'd be the first to say, having really spent time there, you worked shoulder to shoulder with Haitians, you'd be the first to say that they're the ones who, you know, suffered the worst. But you had post-traumatic stress. You know, you describe going home and spending hours at a piano playing The Water is Wide, you know, the old hymn, and seeing a therapist, and sort of ordered to by the AP. Mm-hmm. How are you doing? I mean, you've been talking, you know, you described the scenes of the earthquake to us. Is that hard for you?
It's hard. I mean, you know, certainly going back and reliving a traumatic moment isn't fun for anybody. But you know, as you just did, it's pretty easy to put what I've gone through in contrast to what so many other people are going through. I mean, you know, you described me sitting and playing a piano, and then I had a piano. I was under a roof. Obviously, that was in the States. But then, you know, even when I went back to Haiti, you know, I spent a while in a tent just because, like a lot of people, I did not want to be sleeping indoors. But I had an opportunity to sleep indoors pretty quickly. Within about 2 months, I was willing to take it. My life got more or less back to, I guess, what you can call normal. I'm doing well. I'm fully functional. I have fun. I have a very good life. You know, the memories of what I saw and sort of the ingrained trauma of that experience are definitely haunting. You know, if I'm sitting somewhere and there's an unexpected, you know, rumble, or even if, you know, a big motor starts up outside that I wasn't expecting, you know, I may be, let's say, more acutely aware of it than everybody else in the room. But, you know, my experience paled against the experiences of just millions of other people who were going through this on a much more dire level.
And you're in touch with many of them, your friends. It must have been very hard to leave them behind.
it is impossible to walk away, and believe me, a lot of people won't let you walk away anyway, even if you tried. So it's no, I'm very much in touch with everybody. I've been, you know, we were just speaking with a family today. You know, this was my life. I lived there. I was in Haiti for 3.5 years. These are friends of mine, and this was you know, my neighbors, and this was a place where I used to live. So yeah, no, I keep in touch with people in Haiti all the time, and I was back a couple months ago, and I hope to go back very soon.
That's Jonathan Katz. His book is The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. You can read an excerpt at herenow.org. Jonathan, thanks so much for this really researched book. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
And your thoughts, will it change your response to appeals for help in the future, hearing how little Haiti has improved? Or does it make you want to get more involved? Let us know, herenow.org. We'll be back. The latest news is next, here and now.